Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Interactive Storytelling. My name is Conor Reed, and I'll be your chair for this session. It gives me no end of pleasure to introduce my right. I have the good fortune to work with him for many, many years, and funded many of his creations, including Fallout 2, the Arsenal Dell series, Baldur's Gate, Dark Alliance, and the astonishing game set. If you have not played it, you're really sure it's one of the best games of all time. 2003, yeah, well, In 2003, he and some of his mates split up from Inspiroa and formed a little company called City in Spain. Such was the creative, or such was the way for their creativity, the very first project produced by City was Montreal Project 2. However, the second project, they have just completed the next one to Meister, two very significant titles for a brand new startup studio. I have the luxury of calling these friends. Please welcome Mr. Chris Adler.
Thank you very much, Tony Reed. You are very, very, very kind to me.
For this session, Chris will be fielding questions from the chat, and I have quite a few, and then we'll get into a Q&A session afterwards. And I do strongly encourage you to ask all the questions you have. We are actually deporting Chris on Sunday, so we don't want you to walk away wondering what might have been. So, we'll start with an easy question, because people want to know, how did you get started in computer game writing?
Well, Tony, actually, I got started in computer game writing almost purely by accident. And I don't know if you're in Australia, you guys actually have formal schools for computer game writing. I will say that in the States, we absolutely do not. So the only training that I went through in my high school years was playing a game called Dungeons and Dragons, which I hope you all are familiar with. But I spent many, many years sitting around a table with five or six of my friends just running through adventure after adventure after adventure. And I will say that as far as prepping me for a field in computer game writing, there's probably no better exercise that you can do than having five or six players of different play styles all sitting around a table and giving you feedback on the entertainment that you're presenting. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with the basics of D&D. If not, just hold up your hand and go, please explain to me the basics of D&D. I think we're good. All right. Basically, the way it works is there's one poor fool who's called the Game Master. And the Game Master is responsible for sort of drawing all the maps, writing all the characters, putting all the inventory items on those characters for the thieves to steal or to loot off their bodies once you kill them. Writing up all the quests, sort of making the overall history for these areas. And then the five or six players are the ones who make the sort of game protagonists and then jump into your carefully constructed world and tear it to pieces. So in many respects, it did prepare me for a career in computer game writing because that's pretty much the skill set that you have to develop in that field. So I did that for a number of years, and then I got out of college, and then I realized that I had absolutely no marketable skills whatsoever. But I figured that what I would do is I'd take a lot of the adventures that I'd written for Dungeons and Dragons and actually try to submit them for publication. And that was a very humiliating experience. I will say that the rejection letters piled up and piled up. And the most crushing ones were the ones where I never actually got feedback on anything that I'd done wrong. So like Tony said before, in terms of asking questions today, one thing that I found out early in my career was the one most frustrating things was if I'd ever done a certain piece of work and it was rejected, I never actually got any feedback or answers to what exactly I'd done wrong. So if you guys have any questions or if there's any advice that I can give you, I'd sort of like to correct the sort of injustice that I felt was done early in my career. Any event, so the rejection letters piled up, and then I finally got a break with a company called Hero Games that did superhero role-playing games, because that made me even more of a geek. And then from there, they actually got desperate enough to publish one of my character books, which is basically a whole list of supervillains that I wrote out and then did all the statistics for, et cetera, et cetera. Then I started earning a whopping $50 every six months, which is enough to afford a few boxes of ramen noodles. From there, I finally talked to my editor. I'm like, you know what? I think I might need a real job at some point because what little money I have saved up is rapidly running out. So he goes, all right. I hear this company called Interplay Productions that has just started up a TSR division, which does Dungeons and Dragons, but they're going to do it for computer games. And if you want, I can talk to the director there and see about getting you an interview with them. I'm like, oh, that sounds great. So I flew out to California, and I interviewed with the director of this division called Dragon Play, which is expected probably to do a game about dragons. From there, I ended up getting the job. And then I found out a little bit later on that my editor had actually sold my reference to the director of this division for $300 worth of software. So once I signed the offer letter, the editor ended up with this big bag of Interplay games worth $300, and like my soul felt a little bit smaller inside. From there, Dragon Play grew into Black Isle Studios. I ended up doing more Dungeons & Dragons and Fallout than I ever thought I would do in my life. Did Fallout 2, Planescape Torment, a whole series of Icewind Dale games. In fact, Icewind Dale never really seemed to end. It just kept going on and on and on. Oh, that's right. Yes, perhaps a blight on the RPG culture everywhere. So you have me to thank for that. So if you want to throw stones, feel free. From there, Interplay fell apart, unfortunately. Me and a few of the guys who used to work in Black Isle Studios ended up founding Obsidian Entertainment, to which BioWare was we had a very good, strong relationship with BioWare, and they actually let us do a number of sequels to their products, including Neverwinter Nights. And nice and public too. So.
Right. Well, listening to your panel, Jake mentioned a lot of rejection there, but interesting question to you. We're in interactive media, so how does writing for a computer game compare to writing in non-interactive media, so books or movies?
Well, I guess a lot of my experience involves role-playing games, so a lot of the questions we're going to be answering today are going to be focused around that. The big differences are branching narrative and reactivity. With a lot of role-playing games, you have to sort of take into account that the player is sort of constructing their own protagonist. Like, they may want to create a rogue, they may want to create a skilled diplomat, they want to create a stupid fighter. All of those character options you have to account within the narrative. And you actually want the game world to react to all those choices that they make in character creation. So one good example of that is for a series of games that we worked on at Black Isle Studios and at Dragon Play, there was a game called Fallout. And as part of the character selection process, the player actually had the option to raise or lower their character's intelligence and then jump into the game. Now, what they may not realize at first is that if you go into the game with a very low intelligence and you actually start trying to talk to people, you actually get a brand new set of dialogue options that reflect just how stupid your character is. So you might end up mumbling, slurring your words, people can't understand what you're saying. And that's one little example of like how character creation is actually affecting the environment when it comes to role-playing games. As a side note, one interesting encounter that one of our designers had done for Fallout 2 was for any players that had actually made a low intelligence character and then went out in the world, there was actually another low intelligence NPC, sort of a non-player character that you would meet later on. And if you are playing a stupid character and you talk to that stupid guy, suddenly your speech patterns absolutely do make sense. So you sort of have little subtitles in between the grunts and the slurring that you're doing. So it's kind of an amusing way to play around with the character creation system.
I have two more academic questions for you, and I'm going to delve into your own history. Based on what you've just said, is there any crossover between the two writing disciplines?
The two disciplines that come close to writing for computer role-playing games. One of my designer friends describe sort of writing for an MMO or writing for a role-playing game, much like writing a novel. The player has the sort of choice to sort of explore the world at his own pace, take detours, to explore certain side characters' histories, sort of have random encounters over the course of the quote-unquote book. And I think that's a pretty pretty appropriate analogy for how much writing content you actually have to put into a role-playing game. I'd balance that by saying it's also pretty similar to script writing in terms of how you want to present that world, however. There is a great deal of information that you'll be writing in a role-playing game, but the important thing is that you do sort of want to present it in a script-writing format. A lot of role-playing games are doing a lot more voice acting for all their characters, and what you don't want to have happen is have any story information or any character that you're talking to actually stop the action for any length of time or for any length of basically. You don't want the character you're speaking to sort of paralyze the action for the player. So in that sense, having sort of a script writing aesthetic for keeping character speech brief, to the point, trying to make sure that a lot is communicated through the tone or the context of the area you're in, as opposed to a lot of exposition to what the character was saying.
So are there any writing conventions then or rules that you think you apply to these systems?
Showing and don't telling is a plus. I think a lot of role-playing games end up making the critical error of basically putting the player through node after node of conversation with a character and then forcing them to go through that conversation whether they want to or not. A lot of role-playing gamers don't want to go through a lot of exposition or a lot of talking. So that said, if there's any way to communicate a critical plot point or a foreshadowing event, being able to show that visually is generally a much better way to go. Also, for role-playing games, one thing that you sort of want to do is, even though it may have that sort of novel-like structure that I mentioned, you do want to make sure that the player has a choice as to whether they want to experience that novel structure. And as an example, so if you have a history for a particular area, like you've written out like 300 pages of lore for a certain area, a good example of a game that handles that really well is, I don't know if you've played Blizzard's World of Warcraft, but basically they just have books that are scattered over the environment. And basically in the World of Warcraft, haven't heard of it? Yeah, I heard that in passing. I was considering profession gold farming for a while. apparently gold farmers do make a lot more than computer game designers and creative directors, so it's something to keep in mind. I totally forgot what I was saying.
Writing conventional books.
Oh, yes. Basically, what you want to do is make sure that the player sort of controls the pacing in which they're exposed to those things, and actually the choice as to whether they actually want to read or be exposed to those things. So basically, like having things you can click on in the environment that will give you more information, or including histories of an area and item descriptions if players want to read those. Basically, that's sort of a way of sort of like adding more flavor to the world without actually throwing it in the player's face.
Right. Now to... RPGs, by their very nature, require a very, very significant story. So what I'd like to know from Chris is, how do you go about creating a plot line that's a non-linear in every game you create? How do you sit down and start creating a plot line for the game?
Well, first I go down to 7-Eleven and I pick up a 12-pack of Coke. And then I lock the door and then I just drink a lot of caffeine until the ideas start flowing. But seriously, though, the caffeine part is serious. But basically... A lot of computer game writers I've found actually are always absorbing ideas and information from movies, from books, from comic books, and just from people they know or situations they've experienced. A lot of those things sort of just end up creating sort of this mishmash of mental index cards that'll end up being in the back of your head. So when someone comes to you and they want you to write a story, game story, comic book script, all those things usually end up coming to the surface when you're just trying to go through that initial creative process of trying to decide what kind of story you want to do. I will say for computer game writing, there's one additional element that's very important about it. I've really only had the opportunity to work on a sort of truly original intellectual property once in the 10 years that I've been doing this. to that, I'd say usually I'm working with either a franchise or a publisher's idea for a certain game that they want done. So I've worked with Dungeons and Dragons, obviously. I've worked with Star Wars. I've worked with Star Trek. All of those franchises and the publishers for those franchises, they have a certain number of parameters that they want to see from a game story in a game that you're creating. So the best thing to do is try and get all that information up front before you even start writing your game story. For Knights of the Old Republic 2, for example, LucasArts had a whole list of bullet points for stuff that they wanted us to fit in the storyline that makes the story end up making the skeleton for that storyline. And without that, without getting that list from the publisher first, you'll usually find that you'll just be wasting work by trying to write a story and then getting all that information later on and being forced to revise what you've done.
Well, in keeping with the theme, it's fairly common knowledge that I've inspired some of your best work. How do you go about creating, when I'm not around, the multitude of characters for your game?
I can't tell you guys how many times it's been around midnight and I'm crying and I've hit writer's block and I don't know what to do next and I feel like my life is falling apart and I call Tony and I'm like, Tony, they're going to realize I'm a fraud. Can you help me out? And Tony's just like, calm down, Chris. Take a deep breath. We've been through this before. But for creating characters for computer games, for role-playing games, if given the choice, and we did this a lot with a game I worked on called Planescape Torment, what I try and do is look for a certain theme about a character or a certain cliche that's pretty common in role-playing games. Like we had one character in Planescape Torment that was actually a succubus, and I had always thought for a long period of time that having a succubus traveling along in your party would be a very cool thing. But then it occurred to me that basically the succubus in many role-playing games is very much a cliche. She's definitely got this preset attitude that everyone's used to. She goes around cracking the whip, very overtly sexual, et cetera, et cetera. So I decided to do what would be interesting about the succubus character if you sort of turn that cliche on its head. So I took the idea of a succubus companion, and I thought, well, how do you reverse this? So the first thing I did was like, okay, well, I'm going to say that she's a Puritan succubus. She doesn't like sex at all, and she doesn't like people that indulge in it. So first of all, I wanted players, when they hit that character in the environment, to suddenly realize that there's something absolutely different about this character. And the character, Fall from Grace, she's very well-mannered. She's polite. She's possibly one of the most intelligent characters in the game. And we actually tried to use that sort of turning the cliche on its head for that character to sort of reinforce the kind of world the player was in, where they really couldn't take anything that they'd experienced in other role-playing games for granted. Like any sort of idea or any sort of concept might be turned 180 degrees. And that ended up complementing the kind of world that Planescape was. That said, I don't always have that luxury when doing characters. Like I was describing before about plot lines for franchises, every franchise or sort of a publisher idea for a storyline or a game comes with certain conventions that you sort of have. You should do your best to adhere to your respectful license. And probably one of the best examples of that is if you're setting up characters for Star Wars games, for example. There's certain types of character ideas that are not appropriate for a Star Wars style game. The characters in Star Wars are very iconic. They're very much archetypes. There's not usually any bleeding between the light side and the dark side. You don't want to do shades of gray for a number of characters. You want to keep it very much a space opera kind of theme for the characters that you encounter in the Star Wars genre. In addition, with the franchises that you might be working with, usually people will be buying the game to be exposed to certain characters that they're familiar with for that franchise. Like, they either want to meet Anakin, they want to meet Obi-Wan Kenobi, or if those characters aren't available, they want to meet and interact with people like them, like some variation of Boba Fett or Jango Fett. Like, all those things is what draw people to that genre in the first place. And as a computer game writer, you sort of have to take that into account when creating characters for plot lines. The last thing I'd say is that any characters you create for computer storyline, they should help reinforce the reactivity of the world. Like, they should absolutely have options in their dialogue or in their responses to you that show how your character has been changed in the environment and why you're so cool because of it. Basically, any character you create should have some level of what I call ego stroking for the player when they encounter them. That it can be anything from very minor variations, like they're reacting to what the character is carrying, what sort of weapon they like using, what they did in previous towns, what their reputation might be, either evil or good. All of those aspects, when you're doing the character design, you want the characters to be responding to things the character is doing and making them feel cooler as a result. We usually find that when doing companion characters for characters that join the player's party in role-playing games, they usually end up being the sort of primary means by which you can sort of reinforce the reactivity of the world. Because they're right there with the player throughout the entire adventure, you want to be able to sort of like design those characters so that they'll respond to good actions the player does, evil actions, and you usually end up writing quite a number of lines of dialogue for all the companions to sort of ensure that level of reactivity. So that's a lot of things to throw out there, but that's just some of the things we try and take into account when writing characters for computer role-playing games.
Well, let's take away the structured narrative then. Have you been conveying character to your audience?
A lot of it ends up coming through, and this has been most common the past 2 or 3 years, a lot of it ends up coming through in the context in which you encounter that character. The other aspect is it often comes through in the voice acting for that character. So, for example, with the Fall from Grace, the succubus I mentioned before, a lot of the personality that came through for that succubus actually depended on Jennifer Hale, who did the voice acting for her. She actually created the sort of sophisticated yet pleasant tone for that succubus, and that actually, without needing a lot of exposition to explain how, like, basically to explain her character, she was able to communicate a great deal of that simply through her voice. Also, when you don't actually have that structured narrative, one thing you also want to make sure is that sometimes those characters, those sort of personality can again come out in things that the player actually does and sort of their reactions to things the players do. So, for example, you can learn a lot about a character's personality if you're running through like a village, you're murdering the innocents, like you're robbing chests, robbing houses, and then you have one character that you may not have known so well at the beginning actually starts objecting to that and threatening to leave your party or attack you as a result. You actually learn a lot more about that character based on the actions that your player has done. And that's just some of the elements.
I actually have a story on voice acting. So, how do you pace the story in a computer game when the player actually influences the character?
Well, that's kind of a tricky question because when you actually add a great deal of interactivity to a story, you actually have to sacrifice a great deal of pacing for the storyline as well. You have to recognize that you're pretty much at the mercy of the player when it comes to how quickly they experience the plot. What we've tried to do at Obsidian is we've tried to actually create a series of beat charts that are used for various areas of the game. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with beat charts, but there was a previous lecture earlier on today about usability testing that comes close to describing it. Basically, as players go through the area, we try and look for ways of recording when they get bored or when they're interested in what's going on. And after all the places where they may be coming, where like the plot line may slow down, maybe they're not getting enough information, we try and make a note of that, and then we just try and make sure that we actually populate the area or populate the environment so that something else is going on in between those story points that sort of keeps the excitement level up for the player. But the important thing is, like, you don't want to control the pacing for the player. Like, you don't want to force that upon them. You want them to be able to explore the world at their own pace. It's just your responsibility as a game writer and a game designer to make sure that there's plenty of things in that world for them to do so the excitement level is always high.
Right, so here's the voice acting question. What's your process part to get these voice actors involved in the game?
Well, a lot of the voice acting that we've done for games, we did a little bit at Black Isle Studios as we were doing an increasing amount of Obsidian. Probably the biggest voice acting project we were involved with was Knights of the Old Republic 2. And LucasArts had actually had a lot of experience from the first game in terms of how to handle that, so the process is actually pretty smooth. The way the process works is generally about 6 to 8 months before the game is completed. We actually have to write up character summaries for every character in the game that's going to speak. And that's a lot of work and a lot of information you have to give out to the publisher. You have to indicate what age the character is. You have to provide whatever reference art you can for what the character looks like, a little bit about their background, what sort of tone of voice you want them to have, what sort of post-processing you want them to voice. So when I say post-processing, I mean things like, I want this guy to have a big ringing demonic laugh. For his voice, and then audio actually has to go back to all the voice acted lines and add that for every single line that character speaks. So you give them all the voice casting sheets, and then they begin a long process of doing auditions to find people that actually fit those roles. Now, a number of those roles are usually pretty minor, so getting the exact voice of the exact character that does a super job on it isn't always important. It's mostly for the major characters you want to worry about. They usually allow the development team to listen to the auditions, and then from there, they choose a series of voice actors, and if you're very, very lucky, you actually get to sit in the studio and actually be there while they're going through the lines as well. I can't tell you as a computer game writer how important that is, because when you're dealing with a fantasy world like Dungeons & Dragons or even the Star Wars universe, there are so many ways to pronounce every freaking planet that if one voice actor gets it wrong, that's like 100 lines that you have to go back to the studio later on and spend even more money to get all those lines fixed. And that's not even counting things like if you need to explain the context of where they're saying these lines or who they're speaking to or whether they're angry in this line or not. Basically, as a computer game writer, you actually want to be there in the studio if at all possible and help coach them through those lines so they understand more of the context of where they're actually saying these lines.
So do you find when you're working with a producer, do you have a lot of say as to which voice type on?
We have some say. I know that LucasArts was pretty adamant about certain characters having certain voice actors, but on the other characters that we had, they actually showed a lot of flexibility. So it kind of depends. What I've usually found is that publishers have certain actors that their audio director has worked with and understands their process and their work style, so they're more comfortable with using those and they can coach them better. So I think it ends up working out. I know pretty good all around, but it usually depends.
The questions that, and your timing couldn't have been more perfect, were very specifically about the serious nature of game writing and the importance of narrative going forward. And it was my task to show how much of a production it is for Chris from the get-go to design good character, design great story, and thus keep them very involved in the world that they're in. For any of you that have played Full Metal or Full Metal 2, we would have a very good sense of exactly what Chris has been talking about. What I'd like to do now is probably just lighten it up a bit and feel free at any stage to pop up into our question. My question now would be, really, where do you see computer game storytelling going to? Where's it going to evolve to? Because we seem to be on the second part. There is almost an indie games feel coming up where Jack Williams is already in the more mass market we're not seeing it.
Actually, the answer to this question is a little bit more far-ranging. It's going to be very, very geeky. But where I see storylines going in computer games is basically a Star Trek holodeck. Basically, a computer game writer or producer or cinematographer basically would be inputting a lot of information into a simulation, and then a player would pick and choose what sort of experience he wants to have. I mean, it's cheesy things like, if you saw Minority Report, little cubicles that people would get in and live out their fantasies. All those things, I think, is pretty much exactly where storylines and computer games are going to eventually go. And the big key is because environments like that allow for a great deal of reactivity from the player and a sort of a level of immersion that I think is important for getting a lot of drama out of stories. And I think we're actually seeing a lot of those trends now. I think Nintendo is probably the biggest proponent of sort of creating that interactive feel for stories and game experiences. I don't know how many of you may have a DS or have been trying out the new Nintendo Wii, but the actual controllers for those games sort of lend themselves to a player participating in those games a lot more than just simply jamming buttons on a controller. For example, I was playing a game on the DS called Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney. I don't know if any of you have heard of it, but the microphone that actually exists on the Nintendo DS allows you to get to the courtroom and then start shouting objection into the microphone and actually object to things that people are saying. And I can't tell you how much more that adds to the drama of the story than being able to shout that out in the middle of a trial. We shouldn't do it on a plane. also with the Wii controller, and I hate saying the word Wii. The actual controller itself, you can actually sort of control gameplay by the movements that you make with the controller. So I would argue that, you know, being in the middle of a sword fight with a normal controller game can get a little dull with the analog sticks. But if you actually have that Wii controller in your hand and you're actually swinging it around and you're watching your character on the screen and sort of block moves or like do cross cuts, and suddenly you feel like you're more part of the story. A far more popular game, Guitar Hero, and I don't know if any of you guys have played those. Simply the fact that game has a controller shaped like a guitar, I have seen so many of my friends just lose themselves in that game and just sort of strike the whole rock star pose. They're sitting there rocking out just because the controller feels more like the experience. So I think that's actually where entertainment media is going. Basically just allowing those new opportunities for interactivity. And that was an incredibly long answer.
Well, based on everything you said, that and the more serious questions you answered, made a few notes here. If you were to critique storyline from the Wings and Arts 2, how would you describe it? What's the process? What worked? And more importantly, what did you screw up?
Well, that's a very good question. First of all, I did not write the story for Neverwinter Nights 2. That was actually the brainchild of two designers at Obsidian. One was John Lee, and the other was Farid Bodwin. Those two designers basically sat down. They tried to set up a sort of theme they wanted to see for Neverwinter Nights 2. And what they wanted to do was sort of communicate sort of the grand epic feel of the world they were in. And basically, the setting for the game is this D&D world called the Forgotten Realms, and it's very, very high fantasy. It's a genre that many D&D players are very familiar with. What they actually tried to do, though, which I think was absolutely the best way to go about it, was they sat down, they were like, you know what, we want to do a high fantasy epic game. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen that on a game proposal and been bored to death. I'm like, high fantasy epic, whatever. Like, what I'm interested in and what they provided was they actually broke down what exactly makes an epic storyline and how the player can participate in a storyline like that to make themselves feel more impressive. So they were able to break down the epic storyline in the sense of the player being able to command their own troops and large numbers of them in a war setting, the ability to sort of carve out their own piece of the Forgotten Realms and build a stronghold there, and then actually be able to upgrade that stronghold and make it theirs. And then once they've gone through all those upgrade changes in the stronghold, then it would be attacked by the enemy army, and then all the choices they've made with that stronghold would end up coming into play during that battle. They had a whole list of bullet points for how to make the player feel like they were more involved in greater events, and I think that was one of the best things that came out of the Neverwinter 2 storyline. And it made people feel like they were involved with something that went far beyond just their character. In terms of things that went wrong, one thing that we've recently started to do at Obsidian is that we actually are putting one designer simply in charge of the storyline, the characters, and the voice acting for all the games. We call that person a creative lead. They answer to the lead designer on the game, and they just try and make sure that the story is being followed throughout the course of the game. They make sure that all the characters speak consistently from area to area. They actually attend all the voice acting sessions. They sort of carry the torch for the storyline. we didn't have one absolute person who was involved with that with Neverwinter 2. And I think we put someone on that too late in the game. And I think it would have been better served had we had someone like that from the beginning. Beyond that, I think our CEO, Fergus, would probably say that one of the biggest problems with the storyline was that it was just simply too big. It required a lot of work to get done, but beyond that, I think it turned out pretty well.
Finally, before we open up questions to the floor, I know some of them from our functional questions. Do you want to share any of the war stories you have?
I do have one voice acting war story. I don't know how many people are familiar with Ron Perlman. Perhaps one of the meanest looking actors out in movies today. He was our narrator voice for a series of games called Fallout. And I had the pleasure of writing some lines for him, which I made the critical mistake of not reading them out loud before he went to the studio and recorded them. Unfortunately, the way they were setting up the voice acting sessions for Fallout 2 was they actually had all the voice acting sessions taking place after normal work hours. So they had Ron Perlman. He was probably in the studio all day for 8 hours working on some other project. And then they brought him in late to come work on all the Fallout 2 lines. And he was already pretty pissed off. Like, he was tired, he was cranky, he wanted to go home. And then he got to this one line that I hadn't proofed that he could not speak because I used too much alliteration in the line. Like, he just kept stumbling over it. And rightfully so, because it's a terrible line. And so the next day, the voice director comes back to me and he goes, "I've got a recording of something I want to play for you." I go, "What? Is this one of Ron Perlman's session? Awesome, put it on." He goes, "I'm not sure you're going to want to hear this." I'm like, "No, I do." So I started playing it. And I listened to Ron Perlman trying to say this line. And finally he gives up and he goes, "Who is this Chris Avellone guy? I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill his family." And I thought my heart just stopped. So I was like, "Well, you know what? I'll change my name. I'll go hide. I'm probably never going to have to interact with this guy again." And as luck would have it, 2 years later, he was back for one of our Icewind Dale games. And I'm like, "There's no way I'm going up that voice acting session." And our producer is like, "No, you're going. Because I can't go." So I went up there, and I had the misfortune of not only having to meet Ron Perlman, who was pretty cool up until the point where I had to explain to him that he was going to be playing a transvestite dragon in Icewind Dale, and he just kind of looked at me, and he's like, "It's work."
Ladies and gentlemen, there's a very good reason Chris is considered one of the best story writers in the industry. He has some phenomenal products, and I mentioned earlier, if you haven't played them, it's pretty good. So what we're going to do now is we're actually spot on time, which is brilliant. So open the floor to any questions.
Actually, I have one thing to transition off of what you said before. One thing I also find so cute being a writer, especially as you do more and more voice acting for games, not only do I do a lot of research into movies and reading books and comic books, but also I tend to watch a lot of cartoons as well, just because I can usually try and decipher who's doing what voice in a particular cartoon, and then you can use those as suggestions when you're talking with the publisher about, you know what, the following guy who does the voice acting of this character in Avatar, I think he'd really nail this character really well. And like, even if they can't get that particular guy, they can find someone who sounds like him. I found that actually when you go to the publisher or the voice director with those ideas, like, they get that character a lot faster as well. So that's part of the fun elements of research for doing game writing. So anyway, I'm not getting up to anyone. I know how violent you get.
No, very volatile. So you have an opportunity. You have an opportunity to grill Chris and really probe his mind. Because in truth, one Peter Fortune and back in services there, you're probably never going to go again. So
let's try. I'm already 3 weeks behind on my next project.
Anybody have any questions?
Is that what the line was that the
thing was? No, I can't say it. Because I couldn't get it. I actually do not remember what the line was, but all I remember is I didn't blame him for stumbling over it. It was actually the way Fallout was structured, the narrator actually introduced the game, and then at the end of the game, he would describe all the consequences of your player's actions over the course of the game. And so, like, he had a pretty small opening speech, and then he had, like 50 or 60 line variations for every town, every consequence of meeting a certain person in the game, the results. So he had a lot to get through, and it was pretty exciting.
Yeah, what kind of strategies can I write in to minimize, like I'm writing much in dialogue. Obviously, you kind of end up with a lot of exploding into a lot of dialogue, like a lot of different lines. What kind of strategies can you use to minimize the amount of dialogue you're actually recording while keeping the branching, you know, serious
possible? Well, I guess part of it is that with any of the, especially for role-playing games, you do want to include choke points along the story path, and also in certain characters' conversations as well. And by that I mean you want certain moments in the game that the player has to pass through before they can go on to the next part. You try and make sure that you've done the story in such a way where you're trying to cloak that so the players don't realize they're doing that. But it helps you control all the branching at certain key moments that keep it from going out of control. Because if you do let the player run everywhere and talk to everyone at any time, like, it's much more of a task to do all the writing for that game. We had, like another one or two. We had 9 designers, and 7 of those were actually doing writing for their areas. And it's a tremendous task all by itself. But techniques you can use in actual interactions with characters. Usually, what we try and do is we actually have a spreadsheet that says, okay, this character here is going to react to a good person, and then this character a little later on is going to react to an evil person. And then we try and make sure that we balance out those encounters over the course of the game. So not every character responds to every single trait the player has. We just try and make sure that it's balanced out with a few certain characters in the game. And usually, the kind of character you're writing will suggest those parameters while you're writing them. Like, so for example, like, you know, if you're writing like, if you're hating elf, and then you want to create a separate branch option to a dwarf player to help speak with the elf, like that would suggest itself. And usually, like, when you're doing characters like that, the sort of limited branches kind of suggest themselves.
About how many hours of dialogue do you have to write?
Do you mean like if it was all set at once?
Yes.
Well, the recording sessions, I think, lasted about... this is a guess. I think it was about 3.5 months. That didn't include pickups. Knights of the Republic 1, like, they were very ambitious in saying we want every character in this game to speak. And, like, that was a very brave move. I probably wouldn't have made it. So we followed that trend in the second one. But, you know, one thing that actually helped scale that down is that even some of the characters that were speaking in Knights, we had this these sort of voice lines that were called alien speak. So like whenever you're speaking to an alien, they're the alien babble, but then you would get the subtitle, the text beneath it, what they were actually saying. So that did help minimize it. But yeah, it was a long series of studio sessions. But that was actually kind of frustrating because for 3.5 you can't attend all those. So like then when you get the audio back, you recognize, okay, well these 50 lines, you know, they didn't get the context right, or you know, I didn't explain this enough, and now the whole drama of that scene is killed, and you know. And then even not all the voice acting even made it into the game. And that's another thing to keep in mind as a writer as well. Try to avoid contract situations. If you can become a full-time writer at a studio and start from day one all the way to the end of the game, that's the preferable place to be. There are so many cuts and changes that can take place to a story over the course of the game those last 2 months that you want to be there for the long haul so you can help fix any plot holes that may develop as a result of certain areas getting cut. So. I'm going to let Tony be the one choosing.
Clearly it's very difficult to write dialogue for games because, by and large, it tends to suck really badly in a lot of games I've seen. So, how do you actually write natural-sounding dialogue for a succubus that's about to storm a dragon's keep and do other things that just never happen in real life?
I've said in we have tried to hire people that actually have a very strong writing aesthetic. We find that it's not, and also that writing aesthetic also tends to bleed into other aspects of design too. Like they can recognize cliche phrases. They can recognize when a certain phrase is going to bore someone to death, or they've heard it 1,000 times because they're constantly exposed to it. I will agree with you that writing in the game industry is still somewhat immature. And I do think that a number of plot lines that would not fly in a novel or a movie definitely do find their way into games. And I think the only reason they do end up being okay in games is because they do have that level of interactivity. That because you're participating in the story, suddenly an amnesiac hero becomes a lot cooler because you're the one who's doing it. But what we try to do is how do you prevent that from being sort of against pedestrian? That's part of the creative lead's job. Basically, he reads every line of dialogue, and he goes, you know what, that line sticks, and I know because I've been doing this for 15 or 20 years, and I think that's a dumb thing for a character to say, and it should be revised. Even better yet, here's the revision. So as long as you have one person who does have that aesthetic who's doing quality control. That's the important thing. So basically, you just want to hire good writers.
Have you actually written anything before that, right? Do you like to actually get my one?
Sorry, among the works that I have worked on, I worked on a canceled Baldur's Gate 3, which made me and our Neverwinter lead designer, Josh Sawyer, very unhappy. I can't say how cool that game is going to be. And I also spent about 4.5 years working on Fallout 3, which was not the one being developed by Bethesda, but I put so much of my life into that, I can't even tell you, and it was very, very sad when everybody started falling apart and they did not want to do PC games anymore. Do I hope it gets published one day? No, because it only worked in that setting. But I was very proud of the stuff that we were going to do.
You touched on the concept of like being tried and desired as an alternative. It's possible to get the same kind of character structure in a non-fiction context.
Yes, absolutely do. For example, I can imagine a Ghost Recon style game. Where the voice commands are even more sophisticated, where you're shouting out commands to your the people in your party. I think being able to interact that way could create more drama. It doesn't have to be a role-playing game. I just think the more you allow the player to sort of like be immersed in the experience, that's the important thing. And that can make any storyline stronger just because they can participate more fully in it. I don't know if that answers your question. No. Don't. We can talk more after this.
I'm looking forward to a game where you can sort of empathise with the characters in it, and that's sort of the hardest thing I've ever sort of experienced. There was a brief moment in Jade Empire where I thought the story was sort of powerful enough to sort of feel for the characters, but it's usually held up because of not only the action, but because of the branching that needs to happen. Have you had an experience where you felt you've created a section within a game where the players have potentially empathised at a higher level than usually occurs in these?
Yeah, and the nice thing about role-playing games is usually you can track that information by the choices the player's making. Like, if they're showing an interest in a certain dialogue tree or a certain branch, you can sort of figure out why they're showing an interest in that branch. You can sort of cultivate the experience as a result. One other thing I'd say, too, is, like, when you say empathy, do you mean characters that you understand more or just characters that you get a stronger attachment to?
It's an attachment to it. It's an emotion that doesn't sort of like isn't generated in games usually. And I'm just sort of looking forward to the time when games can do that. And these games are sort of heading towards that more than any other type of game. But it's still sort of like it's fundamentally flawed because there's only so much you can write for the characters.
Yeah, but I think that if you can empathize with a character in a movie, that may be debatable.
It's only because in a movie you control exactly what experiences the audience is going to have one after the other, where the player can be staring at a tree for half an hour and the whole moment is lost. So so that becomes difficult then to sort of say this is supposed to be the crescendo of this relationship, but the players decided to go off into a cave and hunt for gold.
No, but that's still fine, because basically, when describing branching structure, basically you're doing three movies at once, and it's sort of your responsibility as a writer to make sure each of those experiences a certain level of quality, and because the choice the player made, they'll go down that particular movie path that they wanted the plot line to go down. I think that actually makes it stronger. I think that the danger of the problem that you're indicating with the branching is that sometimes the designer may not recognize the branch that the character's going down and have the character respond appropriately in the way the player wants. And I think that does happen a great deal. But I still think that there's a chance to add with the branching that's sort of like an epic movie quality. It's just a matter of doing the world.
Does it frustrate you to write for AI, the limited AI for NPCs? I don't know if you played Oblivion on the 360, where you deal with some great well-written characters, but the system that they've got to use is this weird sort of slider bar where you have to persuade their emotions, and because the AI, the NPC, is so limited, it completely destroys the writing of that character, because the belief in the reality of the character is sort of lost because of the limited AI. I guess that was similar to the previous question.
I think the frustration actually comes in that a lot of the designers in our studio actually do want to add a lot of reactions to every single character. I guess the most frustrating thing that we have found is that doing that amount of work comes with a very large cost.
Yeah, sure. If AI was, for instance, developed so that you could have the Ghost Recon idea you had before you issue a command for more sophisticated commands to your squad, in the same way, if you, for instance, could interact verbally with the characters, but virtually saying anything to them and getting a response back from them. So it's not just limited to what you're writing as a line, for instance, if it's text, or in the case of Oblivion, this weird sort of emotional sort of control system that they're using to actually control whether the character responds back to you. I'm talking specifically about AI NPCs.
It can be frustrating. I'll be honest. A lot of the dialogue for games that I've worked on, the designers and the writers have been allowed to sort of be a part of that conversation mechanic, so I tend to be pretty satisfied with what comes out of it. For our next game, one of our creative lead actually developed a pretty interesting conversation interaction mechanic system. That I think complements the game world and the sort of pace of the setting as well. And I'm kind of looking forward to seeing how that's received. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that as long as you know what type of game you're making and the designers and the writers can be part of that AI system that you're discussing, the frustration is when you can't be.
Yeah, right.
I guess that's all I'd say.
Chris, can you... come across a game yet where the storytelling has been superior to any book that you might have read or maybe what you say, and when do you think that might happen?
Nothing jumps to mind, but that's not because there's not one out there. I just have a spur of the moment. I'm trying to think of one that actually... Oh, I'm not. That's true.
Yeah.
Okay. Tim Schafer games tend to come pretty close. Yeah. I really don't know. I guess I just have to think about it a little bit more.
Same.
Chris, you've talked about you had no career line as a writer getting into the industry, or so how difficult it is, but you get to get on the right. How do
Okay, well, actually, computer game writers now are in a much better position than I was many years ago, because I think companies, especially like Epic with Gears of War, or even titles like God of War, there's a lot of war going on, But they recognize that's absolutely important to bring in someone who actually has a talent with writing, to either do script doctoring, set up a storyline, set up a certain character tones, to do all the work. But, like, that's something they've recently recognized as people seem to be appreciating story more and more. In terms of how to get involved with that, I'm in charge of a lot of the hiring for Obsidian, and I know that the way that we usually get applicants is we actually look for people that have some degree of actual game design experience as well. So if you're interested in actually becoming a part of the game development team and contributing to the writing of that, I would encourage you to actually do some game design experience as well. Even do mods or do build modules or RTS maps. Because basically, your writing as a game designer is going to be only as good as much as you understand the engine you're writing for. It's like if someone tried to write a script for a movie and they didn't understand cinematography. Like, so many other scenes would just be, they just wouldn't work. So what I would suggest is that these are just some general rules. First off, just be persistent. Like, just keep sending your resumes to companies, whether they actually have a position listed or not. Sometimes I have a number of friends at various companies who are actually looking for that position. They just haven't gotten around to posting on their website. So if you're the first person that comes through the email chain, they're like, oh, we already have a writer in the queue. Like, be persistent. The other thing I would suggest is if they do have a creative director or creative lead at the company that you're interested in working for, and do target the company you do want to work for, because there's different game companies that want different things out of their writers. Like, obviously, people who want more Tom Clancy, like Ghost Recon, that's a certain writing aesthetic versus God of War versus Gears of War versus Everywhere Nights 2, etc. So choose your battles and make sure that you actually have writing samples that are appropriate for that. I know a lot of companies do writing tests for applicants as well, like Blizzard's writing test is sort of huge towards World of Warcraft, obviously, et cetera. So it's another company that you're targeting and what sort of writing they're probably going to want out of you. Try and find a creative director or creative lead and just ask them to tour the studio. Just ask if you could talk with them, maybe have lunch with them. Just be persistent, I guess. That's basically what I learned when I was doing the paper and writing. I just kept firing off submission after submission until somebody broke. And once they break, like, then you're in forever. So, well, yeah. So, to do so well.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, according to the program, we are officially out of time. Please join me in thanking Mr. Kirk. I've been in the country much longer, so if you have any questions, feel free to thank you now.